This is WNHN LP 94.7 in Concord and WNHNFM.org. You are listening to Statehouse Watch. I'm Arnie Alpert.
And I'm Maggie Fogarty. We're coming to you from the American Friends Service Committee, as we do every Monday live at 5 p.m. during the state legislative session, rebroadcast Tuesday mornings at 8 a.m.
And we also publish a Statehouse Watch newsletter, which comes out usually on Fridays.
almost
every week on Fridays, usually around 6 p.m. or so, with reports on what has happened at the Statehouse in the previous week and reports on what we think is going to be happening in the week ahead.
And
if you go to our website at afsc.org/NH, you can find a subscribe button, and then it will come directly to you in your email inbox, although you can also read it on our website or on our Facebook page. So you can't avoid us if you won't, unless you really want to.
Right. We won't come get you.
Yeah.
So close Statehouse watchers will know that last week was more or less a vacation week in the House and Senate. There wasn't a session in either body, but
there
committees
were a lot of
met.
Committees meeting, yeah.
That's right.
I mean, the committees are heading toward their deadlines for this year as they approach the what they call the crossover at the end of March, where all the House has to have dispensed with all the House bills and the Senate has to have dispensed with all the Senate bills. So
there were deadlines about bills going to a second committee that needed to be met.
Right. So there's still a bunch. Yeah. Even though it was a vacation week, sort of, there was still a lot that was actually going on.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah.
So, and we took a little bit of, I mean, I didn't really take a break, but we took a break from our newsletter and our radio show last week. And so we're happy to be back and strong and refreshed.
Let's talk about, we've been talking just about every week for some time now about this conflict over the contracts with the state employee unions.
Yes.
And because there was a very interesting meeting today of an obscure committee.
And let's just set the context for a second, which is that state employees are seeking to continue contract negotiations with the state,
right,
with the governor.
There's four different unions, as I understand it, representing state employees. And those are the State Troopers Association, the State Employees Association, also known as the Service Employees International Union, the New England Police Benevolent Association, which represents two different groups of fish and game employees, and then the Teamsters, which represent corrections officers in the state prison system.
And so their process of negotiation had gone to a fact finder
First it actually went to mediation. I believe the Teamsters may have settled, Maggie. I'm not positive on that. I think the Teamsters might have gotten through the whole process.
I remember we heard something
like
that.
But for the other three different unions, they each reached basically a blockage. I don't know if they technically call it an impasse or not, but they requested the help of a mediator. And oftentimes that's a way to resolve things. They went through a process of mediation. It didn't resolve things. So then the next step in the process that's defined by the Public Employee Labor Relations Act, which is administered by the Public Employee Labor Relations Board, known commonly as the PLURB, even though that's not how it's spelled, but we all call it the PLURB anyway. But then the next step is that if the two parties agree, they can bring the dispute to a person called a fact finder, mm-hmm. which is like an arbitrator who looks at the cases made by both parties and then says, here's what I think should happen.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
typically, that's the way things get resolved.
Produces a report.
And the report initially gets held in confidence by the parties. It can lead to reopening of negotiations based on the report as kind of a template, like, okay, here's an outside observer's idea on what would be fair. And then usually that can spark another round of negotiations between the parties. And like 2 years ago, a fact finder's report did lead to agreements being reached with the major union contracts. This time, the fact finder's report was released.
Mm-hmm.
It did not bring the parties back to the negotiating table.
But it talked about the support that it received from union members.
So what the law says is that the fact finder's report, if you don't get agreement, then the fact finder's report is supposed to be referred to the governing bodies of each of the parties, Now, for the unions, they've got their own structures on what their governing bodies are. And in the case, for example, of the State Employees Association, it actually goes to their full membership, mm-hmm. or all of the people who work for the state who are their members who get to vote on it. I'm not sure what process the Fish and Game Union used or the state troopers used, but it went, they referred it to their process, and they all said, yeah, it's not what we wanted. It's not
everything.
It's not everything we asked for. The major disputes at this point are over wages. It's not everything. It's not what they had proposed, but they were willing to accept it as something that would be a fair settlement. The governor, no, they just didn't respond.
Responding in this case would mean putting the fact finder report on the agenda for the executive council.
The executive council, which under the Constitution and under the law is the governing body for the state, because that's who ultimately decides on state contracts, which is what this is. Mm-hmm. It's a contract between the state of New Hampshire and a union representing its workers.
So while they approve contracts, it is the governor who sets the agenda, however, for the executive council meetings, and that is what has not happened now.
So what happened today, Maggie, and to our listeners, which was something that was pretty unusual, was that there was a meeting of a group called the Joint Committee on Employee Relations. Now, I have to admit that as somebody who other people consider to be an experienced State House watcher, I had not heard of this committee's existence until 2 weeks ago when we found out about it. But they are a body that's created by law as part of the Public Employee Labor Relations Act, sort of set of rules and regulations. And it represents – it's made up of, I believe, six senators and six representatives, or five of each perhaps. And they are – specifically exist to review reports from fact finders when the process gets to this point.
And can make recommendations to the full legislature.
Right. So that group met today, and we'll play a clip in a little bit from one of the people who was presenting to it. But they heard from representatives first of the State Troopers Union, then of the State Employees Association, and then of the Fish and Game Union. And then they took a vote, and they voted, I think it was 10 to 2 or something like that. Or, you know, was it 12 to 3? I forget what it was. But they voted by a wide margin that they would then
a bipartisan
refer. I don't believe so, but they agreed that they would refer it to the House and Senate, which is, again, something that I don't believe has ever – I'm not sure that this has ever happened before.
Yeah.
So the House and Senate will then get a chance to vote on basically saying, yeah, we approve of the fact finder's report as a way to settle these disputes. Now, again, it still doesn't mean – that the governor goes along with it. So I don't know.
It doesn't replace the function of the executive council to approve the contract?
I don't know. I mean, I think that this is a little bit of an unknown right now. Huh. And then the other thing is that the State Employees Association has also filed an unfair labor practice complaint with the PLURB, basically saying that, look, the governor, the law says the governor's supposed to put this on the agenda for the governor's council, mm-hmm. and he hasn't done it. Mm-hmm. So he's violating the law. And the governor's saying, no, the Constitution says I have the right to control the agenda for the executive council. So that's another dispute.
So if it's a constitutional question,
it's saying it's a constitutional question and I can do what I want here. And they're saying, no, the law is very clear. So it's so that will my prediction would be that will end up in court.
These are clearly times that are testing norms and and guidance.
Right. When the chief executive doesn't do what the law says,
what's the leverage?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Doesn't
what's
respect
the remedy?
The other bodies of government, like how does this ultimately get resolved? Oh. So anyway, but let's hear a little clip.
Peter.
This is Peter Petrone, who was there representing the fish and game workers.
My name's Peter Peroni. I'm here on behalf of two bargaining units which comprise the Fish and Game's conservation officers. The process itself, and I think it gets lost in all this because we just sort of assume this is part of regular bargaining, but the process contemplates this bargaining. If you can't reach a result, then we go to mediation. If you can't reach a result, then you go to fact-finding. And you go to fact-finding at considerable expense of time and money. It's not cheap. And it's a long process. There's testimony. I don't know how many days we met this time, 4 or 5 anyway. You get a decision, in this case, a decision that was building upon a decision that was not stale at all. The last time we did this was 2018, and you got a decision spring of 2018. We were back in fact-finding, 12, 14 months later. And so That process then contemplates, you get a fact finder's report, you spend all this money. I don't know how many people are sitting there for the state negotiating this thing. There's 10 or 12 at every session. And what happened in this case is we get this report, which, as other folks have suggested, is not some slam dunk for the unions or some outrageous increase. It's a cost of living increase. It's a cost of living increase, 1.16%. Now, Representative Flanagan and Senator Morse, you correctly point out that there is also this 1.7% built into that calculation for the first year. And I think you're right to say, well, geez, what's this if it's just the cost of living increase? The point is, we have a not stale fact finder's report from the spring of 2018 that uses a methodology to go back in time and figure out what's fair and reasonable. Of course, you know, history's funny that way. You can find a different fair and reasonable depending on when you start your inquiry. So Arbitrator Cooper, who was a 2018 fact finder, went back meticulously and laid it all out and said, when the state had no money, when we weren't in the midst of this incredible prosperity, what should have happened to even that out is 4% and change. And what the state came back and said was, no.
No. So they say no or they say nothing, and that's why the process has come
Right. Well, speaking of the process, Senate President Donna Susie says the process is clear. The governor's rejection of the fact finder's reports and the refusal to bring it to the full council for a vote means the legislature must now act on the reports. We hope the full legislature follows suit to deliver a fair contract now for our hardworking state employees.
All right, very good. Yeah,
that was Steve. Anyway, yeah. Although very interesting, the state employees union members were also talking about the high turnover of the workforce and
how
the fact
hard
that
it
a
is
lot
to...
of people are going to be eligible to retire in the coming year. So obviously the implication is if they don't get a raise that they believe they deserve, they might just say, you know what, I've had it, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
And the state is going to be hard-pressed to find additional people to fill those slots.
This is a very important conversation.
Yeah,
so. Well, very good. Well, let's mention one other quick thing before we go to a break and then welcome our guest for today's conversation, and that is that we are following the Family and Medical Leave Bill. It's HB 712, I believe, that has a hearing tomorrow in the Senate. So tomorrow being Tuesday at 1 p.m. in room 100 of the State House. And the Campaign for a Family-Friendly Economy urges folks who care about family and medical leave and want to help make the case for it to show up at that hearing. So see you there tomorrow.
See you there tomorrow. So this is Black History Month. And later on, we'll be joined by Jerry Ann Boggess from the New Hampshire Black Heritage Trail. But as we get into a discussion with Representative Pat Long about issues having to do with children and youth, I thought that this song called Better Get Your Learning, recently recorded on the Songs of Our Native Daughters album, which is about, according to Rhiannon Giddens, it's about the well-known difficulties in the African-American world of the mid-1800s around education. Education, she says, was what the enslaved person wanted above all else, yet even trying to learn to read was often a punishable offense. Songs of Our Native Daughters from the African-American Legacy Recordings. Thank you.
don't we need to know before she told us what was what? She up and died of whooping cough. Better get to learning. Better get to learning. Better get to learning before it goes away. I heard about a school was free way out east in Tennessee before I got to go to town. The damned old Reds had burned it down. Better get to learning. Better get to learning. Better get to learning before it goes away.
Of our native daughters, Rhiannon Giddens and others. This is Statehouse Watch on WNHN LP 94.7.
And we are in the studio with State Representative Pat Long. So welcome, Pat.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Pat, you wear many hats. You are a state representative from Manchester, a Manchester alderman, chairman of the House Child and Family Law Committee. Is that
right? I am.
All right. Say a little bit more about yourself, and then we'll jump in.
Well, I'm a native New Hampshire, born and raised. At 3 years old, I was a ward of the state with the rest of my siblings. My dad was living in Vermont, a drinker, and my mom was a paranoid schizophrenic, so there was nobody able to take care of us. So we were placed in orphanages, foster families, and another orphanage.
How many us? How many siblings?
There's originally there was 12.
My goodness.
Six of us were placed, mm-hmm. And we've all done pretty well. For some reason, I give that to my sister, my older sister Marie Raich, who kept in our life forever. So,
wow.
My calling to family and children law comes from I clearly know that. No matter what age, given an opportunity, a child can become resilient.
Mm.
I'm an elected state rep and an alderman. Go figure.
Yeah. A leader. Really,
exactly. So when you look at the data, I should not be where I am today. So knowing where I am, then it's clear to me where every child has an opportunity to be.
Mm. And your story carries so much meaning for our current context, but I'm particularly struck, as you mentioned, your sister, of the role that family members play, often unseen, in ensuring a child's well-being and holding a family together when there's real suffering
Correct.
Going on.
Yeah, my sister was 20 years old, and she had a child of her own. And she told her husband, no, you're not taking that job in New York or wherever to better support his family because I'm staying here with my siblings.
My.
So God bless her.
Wow. And now as chairperson for the House Child and Family Law Committee, you're in a position to affect the entire landscape of well-being
Correct.
For children and families.
Correct. To give every child the opportunity that they need in the family.
And what an exciting time we're in. I mean, I just have to say there are lots of very significant changes being
made.
Absolutely.
Why don't you say a little bit about what are the kinds of issues that are in the purview of that committee? Because it's, you know, it's different than what's in Health and Human Services, or there's an education committee, for example. So what's distinct about your committee?
So when I first started in children and family law, it was like 7 years ago. I've been state rep for 13 years. But 7 years ago, I was convinced by Mary Giles, Representative Giles, to go on Children and Family Law. She'd bugged me for 5 years to do that. So finally I did. And 7 years ago, the importance of Children and Family Law was focused on parental rights. So it wasn't about children's rights. It was about parental rights. And I had an issue with that because I felt that Children and Family Law, we should be focused on the best interests of the child.
The most vulnerable member of that equation.
Exactly. The only member of the party that – the parties in litigations and in issues that no cause of theirs, they're where they're at. I remember an Office of Child Advocate meeting that they had where I was blown away. It just hit me in the head where two girls – that were in placement, got up and said, I'm in this system not because of me, but because my parents weren't able to parent me. And it just hit me in the head. You're absolutely right.
Right.
You know, that's shameful. So, you know.
So who has their back?
Who has their back? And people look negatively upon them because they're in placement and it's not due to them.
Yes, right, right. And so within New Hampshire, we've had some significant changes in terms of the creation of the Office of the Child Advocate. We have fairly new leadership with the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. Talk about what you're seeing as shifts in terms of the infrastructure to support.
So as far as the infrastructure, I think the two major players that we recently hired a little over 2 years are absolutely what we need. Director Maura O'Neill with the Office of Child Advocate and Joe Ripson heading the DCYF, Division of Child, Youth, and Families. I think they both see clearly what path we need to go in. Now, getting to that path is difficult. You know, New Hampshire tends to be financially conservative. And unfortunately, when you're looking for resources for children, It's a financial resource that'll help. Which shows in
personnel.
That's right, in personnel, which last year, Senate Bill 14, which gave them the avenue with which to get more help. I mean, DCYF offices are all over the state, and in Southern, it's overwhelmed. You know, the Manchester, the Nashua offices, you know, you're looking at 45, 65 cases per intake worker.
Caseloads that are dangerous, caseloads. Right, really?
Absolutely. You know, nobody could cover that, you know, to the best of their ability.
Right.
They could skim over them all, and that's what you could do, but for the best,
you can't respond to what
reduction.
You're seeing. Yeah.
Now they're saying the average benefit is with 12 cases. So let's at least get to 20 and reevaluate it from there.
Right.
So we've had legislation that went towards the best interests of the child, and first and foremost is hiring more caseworkers.
And different kinds of supports, right? I was learning about kinship navigators, mobile crisis units. Say a little bit about how the kinds of assistance is shifting as well.
I mean, the kinship, we just passed, you know, it's just coming through our committee now, kinship where, you know, we look – beyond the family, if there's a coach, if there's a, you know, maybe a church person that this child
trusts,
then why can't we use that? Why do we, you know, why do we have to use what
systems?
What systems say we should use?
Yeah.
You know, and it's just not the case. I mean, I coached football for 30 years. And I recall I told principals, and actually it was in Hooksett, I told the principal of the elementary school, you know, after I told the parents, if there's an issue with a child that I'm coaching, call me in. I'll go visit the child. And they did that, where a child was more concerned, oh, please don't call Coach Pat, please. They you know, and I was easy on them. I wasn't hard on them, but I just taught them how they're representing the team. Mm-hmm. And that's my concern. You know, mm-hmm. you're a good football player. You need to be a good
person
also.
Yeah, wow.
So
that's wonderful.
Yeah.
And so then mobile crisis units and family resource centers and other things like that. Can you talk about that as effective?
Sure. I mean, all the data points to, you know, being a state rep, I get the luxury of going to seminars and things like that. And all the data shows that, you know, we need to stop putting more adverse experiences on the children.
That's right.
You know, you're in middle school and you somehow have a, you know, a mental health issue because maybe you saw your dad get Narcan or something and you're just starting to lose it. What do? We have police go in there, cuff them in front of their friends, mm-hmm. and drag them out. Mm-hmm. You know, talk about
another
adverse.
In that way, we tell
adverse
them who we think they are, too.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, talk about adding on adverse experiences to a child, mm-hmm. that we're doing has the people responsible for stopping that.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So there are things that we must do, that we can do, and all the data shows it. Now it's about getting the resources. And I'm not one to say where are we going to get the money. You know,
because it's the right thing to do.
Well, because we're spending the money if we don't spend it earlier.
Right.
We're already spending it.
That's right.
You know, so,
right.
You know, if it's not immediately coming out of your pocket, it absolutely is coming out of your pocket when those children get older.
That's right. And if they're at the Sununu Center, then we're paying for our failures
absolutely.
Collectively.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, for the, you know, I mean, it's up to $1 million, I guess, now. But when I was advocating for them, it was like $500,000. And I... You know, they were saying, oh, that's too much. Mm-hmm. And I was saying, God bless them. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I wish I was 15 years old getting $500,000 spent on me to help me.
Yeah.
You know, to help me feel self-worth.
Yeah.
You know?
Get back on track.
Sure.
Yep. So there's some federal legislation, the Families First Act, that might support what we're trying to do at the state level. Is that
correct?
Right?
Yeah. There's the Family First Act is coming out, and there's requirements that states must do. And some of them are on the your staffing and how you
would standards like caseloads, you mean?
Well, yeah, not necessarily caseloads, but it can be interpreted as caseloads. It's what effects are you having? It's data driven. So if I have 75 cases and I'm not performing, then that's not good data.
Mm-hmm.
It's data driven. So eventually you say, okay, I need to get people down to 20 cases with the help of the kids. Community services. You know, New Hampshire tends to pat themselves in the back and say, the mobile crisis, okay, we're doing it. But the capacity is maybe they're helping 20 kids when we need 100 kids need this help.
Yeah.
You know, but we stop because we've done something. It only covers 20 kids, so we're all set. Congratulations.
Kind of check
that box. Good for us.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's not the case.
Yeah.
You know, we need to look at capacity and we need to address the capacity need. You know, we wonder why at 7 years old, you know, when they turn 17, we still have issues. And we're like, geez, we've been doing all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, like I was always a proponent of recreational marijuana. I didn't vote for it this time because I went to a behavioral health summit. New Hampshire. And in 2015 or 16, there was a national company that took a survey of kids every state between the age of 12 and 17. And the question was, are there any negative effects on smoking marijuana? New Hampshire was number one in not a problem. So medical marijuana, 2% went to preventive. I think that's got to be 20% anyways.
2% of revenue
2% of the revenue generated was going to prevention. We're obviously not doing prevention if our 12 to 17-year-olds think that there is not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to put more of that effort in there.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Well, so we have resources flowing. There's clearer thinking about the kinds of programs that make a difference, the ways that services can be delivered and thought through that might be more impactful for people.
Correct.
And when might we start to see the real results of this important shift?
Well, with Family First, it's data-driven. So no longer can we say, well, we're doing what we can and we're going to try something else. We're not going to stop. We want the best services for our children. That language is going to stop because throughout the country, there are programs that are helping these kids. And so it's no secret. You don't have to be a first. You have to implement these programs.
Great. You are listening to Statehouse Watch on WNHN LP 94.7 in Concord. I'm Arnie Alpert.
I'm Maggie Fogarty, and we're in the studio with State Representative Pat Long, chairman of the House Child and Family Law Committee. Maybe let's be sure to focus on the committee now for a little bit since you do the policy making and I'm sure give recommendation to bills that also end up in the budget related to all of this. But the first thing I want to remark on is what I remember from last year was some news about some attempts to maybe take away the Child and Family Law Committee, and it survived and it thrives from what I understand as a truly bipartisan place. Can just talk about the life of your committee.
Well, you know, I'm going to say that last year's session, we probably had out of 28 or 32 bills, I think it was, we had two fights on the floor. So I give the Republicans on that committee credit because they get it.
Well, and then probably that means that you deserve credit as well for being able to maintain
your
an environment.
Leadership.
Because again, the way these committees work, some of the committees I think are very collegial and some of them are less so. And the leadership of the chair has a lot to – not that all the chairs are to blame when their committees don't act in the best fashion. Yeah. But certainly when they are – it does reflect well on the chair.
I mean, it's respect is the bottom line. They got elected just like I did, so I respect that fact. Whether they disagree with me or agree with me, that's okay. Disagree with me. Let's have the debate.
Let's
not hate each other because we disagree with each other. Let's have the debate. So it's been successful. So that's good. What we're looking at is legal representation for children. There is none.
For cases of abuse and neglect, or is this across other settings?
Across the board. In divorces, in abuse and neglect. You know, you have a GAL.
Guardian ad litem.
Guardian ad litem. But if you have a court-appointed special advocate, that's good. But a regular guardian ad litem doesn't see the child enough. And we're seeing that clearly. So why are we spending money on that where – court-appointed special advocate program they reject some cases because they don't have enough volunteers. It's important to get the volunteers out in there. I did that for 5 years, and that was in 90 and 90 to 95, and I saw clearly that at 12 or 13 years old, a child was written off by the court system to he's going to be going to the big
house. Just get his bed ready.
When he's an adult. Yeah. That's right. Where that's changing now. We're realizing even at 17 years old or at 22 years old, you can instill resilience and
address some of the underlying issues that are showing up. So what's that bill number? This would provide representation for
HB 1249. There's a couple of bill 1138.
Yeah,
expand the rights of minors to legal representation.
Is that a study commission or is that a straight up?
That's a commission. However, there's a straight up. Here we go. Yeah, 1249.
Okay.
The children in the juvenile justice system. So we're also looking at a lot of grandparent issues. I mean, I know in Manchester, I talk to a lot of grandparents that have their kids, and the two major things they ask for is help me to understand my child. That is in this dire situation. Mm-hmm. I don't understand it. One of them called me the other day saying I made a mistake. I invited my daughter over for dinner. They have the grandchild. And she was still on opiates and it just didn't turn out right.
It was chaotic for the child.
So he doesn't know. You know, any parent wants their child to have their children back.
Yes.
So they want to learn what is it that I can do.
Right.
That,
what's
obviously,
my unique
inviting
role?
Her to dinner was not the right thing to do. I hurt my, you know, the grandchild.
Yes,
you know,
right. It could be like a betrayal of the childhood.
Exactly. So they need to learn what it is that they could do,
mm-hmm.
And also respite. You know, they're retired. They didn't expect to have this.
I mean, be elderly.
I get my granddaughter for a night, and it's like, whoa.
Yeah.
Here you go.
Yeah.
Have a nice life.
I'm going to take a nap.
Yeah. Now imagine having her all week, right? Having guardianship of her.
Yeah,
every week. That's right.
Not just a week, but she's there.
It's,
yeah,
you know, we're not, you know, and I, you know, we're not prepared for that.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't plan for that.
Right.
We'll do it. Absolutely do it. So that kind of respite, they need a respite.
So is there a bill that addresses respite opportunities?
No, there's – I mean, we're just starting to allow grandparents to use some of these social services that are out there.
Oh, of course.
Where before there wasn't. They didn't realize I could use SNAP.
Yeah.
I could get vouchers for clothes for the child.
Yeah. So just getting that information out then,
So just getting that information and just – you know, the general court just – passing that a couple of years ago or a year ago,
mm-hmm.
Is widening up to these grandparents.
Very good.
So the system has to be tweaked in order for grandparents to be able to access the services that we typically have expected parents to be able to.
That's correct. Well, first they got to know.
Yeah.
You know, then the other issue is, you know, I get call from parents, grandparents that are in Section 8 or public housing. And they're afraid to tell somebody that they have their grandchildren because I'm going to get thrown out. I'm only supposed to have somebody here for 14 days.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, so they're afraid. I learned that through the census. They're not going to get the true census. This grandparent's not going to say, I got my 8-year-old and 10-year-old living here with me.
And I don't know how long they're going to be here. And,
exactly.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So getting those barriers, you know, crossing those barriers, I mean – you know, I know, you know, like Manchester Housing may have to report that, but come on, there's got to be a way to
reach common goals
here. Now we got grandparents and grandchildren in the streets.
Right, right.
You know,
like how does anybody win
that? It just doesn't make sense.
Can we – I know that time is flying by, but I think in your committee is a bill that would continue to raise the age of marriage in New Hampshire.
Yes.
Representative Cassie Levesque.
Yep. Yeah, we just heard that. We'll be executing it tomorrow.
Okay.
I – you know, we're getting the typical service people – what if they get some 16-year-old pregnant and they're not going to get the medical benefits, which is just wrong.
So this is there was success in a previous legislature to raise the age of marriage from 13 to 16, right?
Correct.
And this would raise it further to 16 18?
16 to 18, yes.
Okay.
And, it looks like it'll go through with some language that was already tested in Delaware.
Okay.
And shown to be constitutionally.
Okay. The language being an exception for military spouses, you mean?
No, not an exception for military spouses, but it's something to do with I just got the amendment Friday. Something to do with who can perform the marriages.
Oh, okay. I see. All right. So I know we don't have enough time to cover all that's before your committee, but I know there are other issues that you're watching and supporting related to corporal punishment. And I've seen some child welfare issues in the Education Committee related to the overuse of suspensions and expulsions. That's not your committee, but it certainly pertains to the same context of what are we throwing away our children or are we really acting in ways that center their well-being, their best interests?
Yeah.
Well, Representative Pat Long, thank you so much, not just for your time today, but for the ongoing wonderful work that you do on such an important set of
thank
issues.
Thank you for your work, both of you.
Well,
this
it's a
awesome.
Pleasure to be with you.
Pleasure to be with you.
And our songmaster is going to take us into a musical
great. Thanks,
break.
Thanks, Pat Long. Well, it's actually not a musical break. It's a poetic
right.
break. This is Black History Month, and I thought, what could be better than the voice of Langston Hughes?
Hmm.
This is The Negro Speaks of Rivers, one of my earliest poems, written in 1920, just after I came out of high school. The way this poem came to be written was that I was going to Mexico to visit my father, who lived in Mexico City, and on the train going across the Mississippi River, just outside St. Louis, I looked out the window and I saw this great muddy river flowing down toward the heart of the South, and I began to think about what this river had meant to the Negro people, how, in a sense, our history was linked to this river, how in slavery time, my grandmother told me that to be sold down the Mississippi was one of the worst things that could happen to a Negro slave. And then I remembered that I'd read about Abraham Lincoln going down the Mississippi as a young man, and he went on a raft to New Orleans, and he saw human beings bought and sold in the slave market there, and he was so horrified by this that he never forgot it. And many years later, of course, we know that it was Lincoln who signed the Emancipation Proclamation. And so, as the train went on into the gathering dusk, because it had been about sunset when we crossed the river, I took my father's letter out of my pocket and began to write down on the back of his letter this poem, "The Negro Speaks of Rivers." I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo, and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I have seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers.
That was Langston Hughes in his own voice reading "The Negro Speaks of Rivers." Thank you, Arnie, for finding that and sharing that. You are listening to Statehouse Watch Radio. I'm Maggie Fogarty.
I'm Arnie Alpert.
And we are being joined now by our friend Jerrianne Bogus, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Black History Trail. Welcome, Jerrianne. Are you there?
I am. Thank you so much, Arnie, for having me on your program.
Yeah, I'm Maggie, yeah.
Yeah, we're delighted. It's good. It's a good connection, I think, while every day should be Black History Day and every month should be Black History Month, we're pausing a little belatedly to honor some of the learning opportunities that get created in the month of February. And certainly your work contributes enormously to folks throughout the state in a very deep way.
Yeah. Jerrianne, since this is your first time joining us here on Statehouse Watch, I wonder if you could begin by just saying a little tiny bit about yourself, but also about the origins and the development of the New Hampshire Black Heritage Trail. And I'm really interested in particular in how you're taking it from a Portsmouth focus to a statewide focus.
So, Arnie, as you know, the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire is an outgrowth of the Portsmouth Black Heritage Trail in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, which was started by Valerie Cunningham almost 25 years ago, and drew in her work as she was researching black history in Portsmouth. She found lots more documents about documented history about other towns, other people, other places in New Hampshire. And collecting this information, I had been the vice president for Portsmouth Black Heritage Trail for a while, a nonprofit. And we looked at all this information that we had and said, you know, we need to branch out beyond the seacoast and share this history with everyone. And that's how we got started as the statewide trail, because there was so much information collected across the state. And one of our founding members, who actually just recently died a week ago, Charlie de Grand Prix, actually formed our organization, the Black Heritage Trail of Incorporated us, the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire. And our goal was, through sharing this information, through raising awareness of New Hampshire's black history, creating programs that highlight the stories, celebrate our black history, move beyond the stereotypes of who we think we are as black folks, what people think of us, the history, the stereotypes, and create this rich visual acknowledgement of this history, and create, by so doing, create more inclusive communities. So our programs and the trail, making all this history visible, became really important to us. And creating programs where people can come together to talk about this history, how what's happened in the past, what's happening now, and how the history can change or create our better future, live up to this dream of a more inclusive communities, is our goal.
Well, Terri-Ann, I certainly first heard of you in relationship to your work to bring forward the life and legacy and the writing of Harriet Wilson in Milford. So I wonder about that particular story and whether there's one or two others. I mean, I'm grateful that a lot of us are now familiar with the stories of people who were enslaved and living in Portsmouth because of the work that Valerie and others have done, and the beautiful African burial ground that's there now. But these stories from other parts of the state need to get told as well. So what else is out there for us?
There's so many more stories across the state, and you know, again, this rich, vibrant history. I mean, Harriet Wilson in Milford, the first black woman to publish a novel in English, was born and raised in my town that I live in. And in doing her research and bringing her story to light, creating the first monument to honor a person of color, Harriet Wilson, in her hometown, we've come across so many other black history stories. George Blanchard, the first veterinarian and Revolutionary War vet in Milford. And we go to Jaffrey, where we have Amos Fortune, a man who was able to purchase his freedom when he was in his 60s. And in the end, he became a valued, highly represented citizen in Jaffrey, leaving a legacy, a library legacy, and their lectures, his endowment that he left to the town, still create these Amos Fortune Lyceums in the town of Jaffrey. I'm trying to look at the map, going up to Keene, there's the story of Lost Boundaries, the Johnson family story of passing that was made famous in a Louis de Rochemont film in the 40s. And why am I blanking on the name?
Anyway, I know that there was something in Hancock, I believe. There's stories out of Warner.
In Hancock?
In my own town of Canterbury, there's some interesting history that, you know, it's not what I think most of us in Canterbury think of when we think about the history of our own town.
No. Bringing these stories, these Reverend Samson Battis in your hometown, bringing these stories to light shows that African Americans, formerly enslaved people of color, were vibrant and rich and participatory in all areas of our state, creating that fabric, you know, that we know now is New Hampshire. The first magician, famous magician in the country, lived in Andover, Richard Potter.
Potter Place,
exactly, named after Richard Potter. But we forgot who Richard Potter was, and we have the names of places. Coit Mountain was named after Vance Coit, who was a Revolutionary War veteran, and there was a colony, is what they call them, a group of formerly enslaved Revolutionary War vets who settled at the base of Coit Mountain. And, you know, there's so many rich stories when you start looking, and they just create a much more vibrant and inclusive picture of our state.
So many people appreciate the very well-designed, very thoughtful, well-led tours of the Portsmouth area. Are you constructing similar kinds of tours in other communities so that people can do a walking history?
So right now we're developing the walking tour in Milford. We will have what we've done with Portsmouth is we offer guided tours. We have a self-guided tour book, and we have an audio tour online, and we're doing the same for each area that we go to. So Milford is on the next one. We're in the process of publishing the book, with a guided tour of self-guided tour of 22 sites in Milford connected to Harriet Wilson and the abolitionist movement. That we'll create an audio tour of that. We've done a tour in Hancock, Warner. We've done a guided tour in Warner, New Hampshire. They have an African burying ground there too, and over 17 sites that we toured this
17.
Past summer. Yeah, over 17 sites. So we will offer those tours again this year, Warner and Hancock. This year we will be adding a tour to Exeter, and that's another rich, vibrant town. And we hope to do a tour of Jaffrey and Keene this year as well. So as we grow and as the manpower allows, we're adding these guided tours, and we will develop a book of self-guided tours so people can do that on their own as well.
I hope the nearest school districts to every one of those locations will build this in, whether it's for the fourth grade or whatever grades we're looking at our history as
a state. Well, speaking of schools, I believe that you've also been talking about how to bring some curriculum into our public school education in New Hampshire.
I think we're really busy and covering a lot of
work. All right, no, I know that. You are amazingly busy. I mean, I can't keep track of it all, but I know that I keep hearing about these other ideas and coming up. How does Jerry Ann do all that? Anyway.
Yeah. When you said that, I went, phew, that sounds like a lot. But, yeah, we did develop a curriculum for Portsmouth. We're working with the Portsmouth School, and going beyond that, the Warner the Moffett Ladd House, they have created a curriculum as well that we work with the Warner House, the Moffett Ladd House as well. So Portsmouth is really, really deep in curriculum development. We're just starting to reach out to engage the teachers in Milford to create the Milford curriculum development. And we have a new program. We have one of our volunteers will be working to reach out to the schools, K-12 schools, and work with them to develop curriculums in the areas that we are expanding in.
Amazing.
So we look at, maybe two or three towns at a time and see, Portsmouth is in the totally developed stage. So what's next? We're looking how we work with a school that's already done the tour, that has the curriculum. How do we deepen that relationship? Milford, we've developed the tour. We're working on the curriculum, so that's a phase two. And Exeter is like our next step, where we're just starting to move, to look at how we can engage in the town along with the historical societies and the school to create and raise this awareness for the history. The Black history in their town.
And then for ongoing learners of all ages, of course, there is the series of Tea Talks.
Absolutely.
Yes, say a little bit about that.
So the Tea Talks are community dialogue talks, and we host them in Portsmouth for the month of February and 2 weeks in March, so that we're not just doing Black history in February. But so we have six of them. They're theme talks. This year the theme is we're looking deeper into how we believe. The theme is what's belief got to do it and how we believe, what we believe, why we believe. So we look at all these, personal stories, historical stories, psychological biases and, how medicine has reinforced notions of racism and, just all these really difficult conversations. But we do this in a pretty safe environment where we can engage the community in these difficult dialogues. And we bring experts who can talk on the subject, as well as community members, as well as people who can share their personal stories and create each person. We have a panel. They talk for maybe half an hour of the two-hour program, and then the rest is the dialogue with the audience.
Excellent. I've been to some myself and have always been very stimulated and and very glad to be there. And I'm glad there are two more for folks who might just be hearing about it now.
Well, and I like the idea that this is it's the Black Heritage Trail and it's about Black history, but it's also very, very current. I mean, the topics that you picked, right, Jerry Ann, are not about what happened hundreds of years ago. That's about what's going on right now in our world and in our community now.
Yeah. We use history to get us to talk about current issues. So, for instance, if we look, the last talk we had on Sunday was about racism in education. So we had a teacher, a professor from UNH, who talked about the history of a segregated school, which actually we were all shocked to find out started in Boston in the 19th century, and not down south. And then we had a woman, Mabel Barnett, who was part of segregated schools when she lived in Malden, Mass.
Wow.
So, and then we had two other experts, Liz Canada, who talked about what's going on in our schools now here in New Hampshire.
All right. Well, Jerry Ann Bogus, we are so grateful for you to take time with us. How do people find out more about the upcoming Tea Talks and all the other great information from the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire?
On our website at the blackheritagetrailnh.org. All our programs and offerings are on our site.
All right.
And where we're going and where we're going.
All right. Well, great. And we're always glad to get the announcements, and we try to put them in our State House Watch newsletter, which always has a calendar section in it. So thank you so much for being with us today.
You're amazing.
All right.
Thank you both.
All right.
Thank you so much.
All right, great. Maggie,
what
else is coming up we want people to know about?
All right, well, we've got some upcoming Tea Talks. Tomorrow, March 3rd, too, is an Interfaith Prayer Vigil and Jericho Walk at the Norris Cotton Federal Building. The first Tuesday of the month, those vigils are always followed by the meeting of the Immigrant Solidarity Network, which this time will be at the Manchester UU Church, starting at about 10:30.
All right, good. Representative Long's comments about issues about tenants and their questions reminded me that we've got a great program coming up with Elliot Berry.
Be amazing.
What date is that, actually? I've got mixed up about
that. Yeah, I think it is tomorrow as well,
tomorrow,
March 3rd.
Tenant Rights Forum with
is
Elliot Berry,
right?
New Hampshire Legal Assistance.
No, I think it's the 4th. Okay, sorry,
we'll
folks should look
anyway.
It up on Facebook.
6:30 p.m. At the Unitarian Church in Manchester.
That's right.
Okay, let me just double check on the time on that. That is on Thursday of this week.
Thursday the 5th.
That's going to be. And that's brought to you by Progressive Manchester and the Manchester Housing Alliance. You might have heard the announcement right before the show from Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! That tomorrow, right here on this station at 7 p.m., we'll be hearing about the results of Super Tuesday with Amy and the people from Democracy Now!
That's going to be a long night given all the time zones.
That
will
Maggie,
be
what is happening on Saturday at
on
the Canterbury Quaker Meeting House?
March 7th at 7 p.m. at the Canterbury Quaker Meeting House, we will be celebrating and fundraising for the Arnie Alpert Action Fund with music by Steve Shook. Is that how he says his
yes,
name?
Yes, it is.
Storytelling by Representative Rennie Cushing and Barbara Keshen. And just a good evening to be with friends and lift
right.
up great work.
Great. And we're trying to raise money to keep going the work of the American Friends Service Committee in New Hampshire, which right now includes our State House Watch project. So we want to thank you for listening. We want to thank our producer, Fred Portnoy, our engineer, Fred Portnoy, and our volunteer coordinator,
Fred Portnoy.
All right, for keeping this on the air. We want to thank everybody for listening. We want to thank all the donors to WNHN, and we'll be back next week. And right now, we're going down the road.
I want to be treated this over. Going down the road.